So I want to continue with the theme of awakening. How does that sound? Awakening good? Okay.
I'm for it.
So last time, last week, we looked at the teaching of the seven factors of awakening. And previous to that, I had talked about traditional models of awakening, the sense of awakening coming from the teachings of the Buddha. And last week, we looked at the very specific intent teaching on seven qualities, which I mentioned at the beginning of the meditation, which are those that both reflect awakening and that lead to awakening. Again, seven qualities, the first of them being mindfulness, a balancing factor, and then three energizing factors, inquiry or investigation, energy, virya, joy or rapture, and then three stabilizing factors, namely tranquility, samadhi or concentration, or unification of the mind, and equanimity. And today, this evening, I want to continue to explore awakening, but bring in a core question. I'll review very briefly the traditional understanding of awakening, both in the teachings of the Buddha and in some later Buddhist traditions. And I'll ask the question, is the traditional understanding of awakening enough for our practice? Is following the traditional teaching about awakening an adequate guide for us in the contemporary world? So I'm going to ask that question. And I'm going to actually suggest that it's not fully adequate, and that we need, in a way, to develop an understanding of awakening and ways of practicing that get at core forms of our conditioning and our confusion and ignorance in ways that the traditional teachings and practices only do partially. So that's what we'll be discussing. So I'll say that in advance, and we can explore that and see if you find my line of reflection and questioning to your liking. See whether it makes sense. So again, the traditional understanding of awakening given by the Buddha, mostly given in terms of what we overcome, what we work through, what we transform. In other words, the sense of awakening is given more negatively. It's the awakening is the absence of greed, hatred, and delusion. So from the Dhammapada, those who fully cultivate the factors of awakening, give up grasping, enjoy non-clinging, and have destroyed the toxins, the negative qualities of our being, they are luminous and completely liberated in this life. And there are a number of different ways that the Buddha conveys this notion of awakening, again, not being the text that we have not being systematized. We have a variety of teachings. We have teachings, I think I mentioned last time, called the Bodhipaccha Dhamma, a more extensive list of 37 qualities that we develop when we develop awakening. you know, which are outlined in teachings like the seven factors of awakening, the four foundations of mindfulness, the four ways of skillful effort, and so forth. And there are other terms like vimutti is almost a synonym of awakening. It's usually translated as liberation. And it's said that there can be a kind of temporary liberation, for example, when we're really fully immersed in loving kindness or joy. We're actually in states of samadhi or concentration. There's a temporary freedom from greed, hatred, and delusion, but it's not permanent. You know, when we come out of that state, the greed, hatred, and delusion shake our hands, so to speak. There's also, somewhat rarely, a more positive account of awakening, what we could call a kind of awakened awareness. That's been very important for me and I think teachers like Philip and others. And that is of a kind of awareness which we develop and which we can touch, which the Buddha, in just a few passages, labeled with three main words. He labeled this quality of awareness as signless, meaning beyond conceptualization, boundless, meaning that the sense of awareness is infinite, vastly expansive, and all luminous. And he said there is a quality which some have identified as actually what we experience when we touch Nibbana. You know, even when we have some of these states like stream entry that are described in the text. The Buddha says where consciousness is signless, boundless, and all luminous, that's where earth, water, fire, and air find no footing, no concepts. Both long and short, small and great, fair and foul, name and form are wholly destroyed. And in later Buddhist traditions, there's something very similar that's identified. In fact, one of the main traditions that's a foundation for insight meditation in the West, the Thai Forest tradition, identifies something very similar. And I've sometimes talked about this, you know. So for example, we have really the main founder of the Thai Forest tradition in the early 20th century, Achan Mun, talks about the radiant mind. He talks about it as being beyond the so-called three characteristics, being beyond anicca, dukkha, anatta, being beyond the laws of impermanence, the nature of dukkha, and the teachings on not self. He also talks about it as the primal mind, as being radiant and clear by nature, but it gets darkened by the greed, hatred, and delusion. So they're pointing to something we could call awakened awareness. It seems to be beyond conceptualization, very much like what people nowadays talk about as non-dual awareness. That can be touched and that can be one's resting place with training. Can be a more positive account, in other words, of awakening. Achan Cha talks about it as the old mind. He says, we are practicing to reach the old mind. The original mind is unconditioned. There is no good or bad, long or short, black or white. Very similar way of talking. The nature of the original mind is unwavering. It is tranquil. Practice really means searching to find our way back to the original state, the quote unquote old thing. It is finding our old home, the original mind that does not waver and change following various phenomena. It is by nature perfectly peaceful. It's already within us. And we find resonance in later Buddhist traditions as well, in Zen tradition. And I'll mention just Maybe one other quotation from the, this is from the Tibetan Mahamudra tradition. And we find something very, very similar, talking about in Mahamudra, the nature of mind, very similar language. In Dzogchen, talking about Rigpa, translated often as awakened awareness. This is a passage from the 16th century. It's talking about a quality of our being that is open like the sky. This is Dagpo Tashi Namgyal. Open like the sky, pervasive like the earth, unshakable like a mountain, shining like a flame, lucid like a crystal. And so the traditional, this is really a sense of the traditional model of awakening that most commonly described negatively as the absence of greed, hatred, and delusion, sometimes described more positively, occasionally by the Buddha, mostly in the Thai forest tradition and Tibetan traditions like Dzogchen and Mahamudra, and sometimes in Zen, often not. And so, again, they're in traditions like the Thai forest tradition and Tibetan Dzogchen and Mahamudra, there also are techniques to access this kind of awareness. I should say that we often have something like this non-dual luminous awareness. We sometimes have this appear in our experience, you know, that this can appear at moments. Sometimes when we're in the wilds, we have moments of a sense of unity and expansiveness. It can appear sometimes in the moment of creativity. When we're totally immersed in something, something can open up sometimes. It can also open up sometimes in very close and intimate relationships, where something, some natural capacity of the mind of our being opens up. And it can just be there for a taste, for a small moment. How many have had those kind of experiences, right? So this is, I think this is the majority of people here tonight. And there are also ways in the traditions, particularly Thai forest tradition and the Tibetan traditions, where there are methods to cultivate this quality of awakened awareness, sometimes called pointing out instructions. And when I teach the retreat, which some of you have done, called Settling, Seeing, and Spacious Awareness, I offer a number of techniques. And it's not very hard to access this quality of awareness. It's quite hard to have it get stable and be there more and more. It's hard in meditation and it's harder in daily life, but it's very possible. Right. And so this is really the traditional model of awakening. How does it sound? Anyone want to sign up? Okay. We have a few hands, so we can access this beautiful awareness, cut through greed, hatred, and delusion. So what am I talking about when I say that those teachings may not be all of what we need? What am I talking about? So that's what I want to explore for the rest of the talk and then have some time to talk together. So these are beautiful, beautiful teachings. So a few questions. Do these teachings permit us to get at all of our forms of conditioning, confusion, and ignorance? Is there a need for a more contemporary account of awakening? Some people have actually answered that positively and said that we need in our times what could be called a fourth turning. It's sometimes said that there have been three turnings of the wheel in the history of Buddhism. The first was the turning of the wheel by the Buddha. The second, sometimes said to be the turning of the wheel 500-600 years later with the Mahayana tradition. the teachings on emptiness, especially, teachings on the Bodhisattva, sometimes said to be a second turning of the wheel. Not said like that in the teachings of Theravada and that we've received from South and Southeast Asia, but in the Mahayana tradition, sometimes said to be a second turning in a similar way. The Vajrayana teachings coming out of India, later brought to Tibet, sometimes said to be a third turning of the wheel. And there have been people who said, we need in our time a fourth turning of the wheel, not a radical move away from the first turning or the second turning or the third turning, but there is a way that we need, as it were, a contemporary sense of awakening. So, for example, one person who said this was the teacher of the Untouchables named Ambedkar, you know, in India, teacher of the Dalits. You know, he said, basically, I don't think we have a good home with what is now called the Hindu tradition, with the caste system as part of it. And he did a survey. This would have been in the 40s and 50s. He did a survey of all the world religions. He wanted to say what tradition would be a home for us as untouchables. And after doing a survey of all the world's religions, he said, Buddhism is a good home. And in 1956, there was a mass conversion of the Dalits to Buddhism. And they've had a very interesting series of teachings and formations coming out of that, which has influenced some of the Western traditions. Friends of the Western Buddhist Order comes out of that connection. And Ambedkar said, for example, that there have to be teachings that talk about social justice. You know, that there have to be, and he said that the figure of the monk who is separate from, or her nun, who's separate from social issues is not a good model for us. We need a fourth turning. You know, we need some other models of what a mature practitioner is and some teachings for him, particularly bringing in the social dimension. You know, there's been something similar, some of you know, in the integral philosopher Ken Wilber's work. He talks about a fourth turning and talks about a different way of understanding awakening. He says there actually, we should conceptualize four dimensions of growth, of which waking up is only one of them. He says there has to be a whole sequence by which we wake up, another one in which we grow up, connected with, you know, developmental psychology. So he's going to be more or less especially saying that the fourth turning has to deeply integrate Western psychology. So he talks about waking up, growing up, cleaning up, which is working with your shadow and your unconscious material, and then showing up, which is his word for being active in your world. So it's a way of talking about a fourth turning. Waking up, but not stopping there. Growing up. And cleaning up and showing up. And I think there are other reasons that we can give for why we may need to look more deeply at this model of awakening. One of them is the shocking reality that a significant number of teachers who seem to have many dimensions of traditional awakening, to put it briefly, behave badly. How many of us are familiar of the bad behavior of seemingly awakened beings? Okay, right? And so, you know, we could point to a number of these, you know, ranging from many of the great Zen teachers of the 20th century who were aligned with Japanese fascism and promoters of Japanese naturalism and Japanese fascism. You know, I found there's a lot of scholarship in the last 25 years. There was a book that was called, called Zen at War, which documented a lot of this. This is from one of the great Zen teachers of the 20th century, one of the primary persons responsible for bringing Zen to the West. Yasutani Roshi was also deeply anti-Semitic. In 1943, in a book, this is what he wrote. It is therefore necessary to thoroughly defeat the propaganda and strategy of the Jews. This is 1943. We must clearly point out the fallacy of their evil ideas advocating freedom and equality. The general citizenry become fascinated with the ideas of freedom and equality as advocating by the scheming Jews. We must be aware of the existence of these demonic teachings of the Jews, right? Along with someone who seemed to manifest, was called a Roshi, seemed to manifest qualities of awakening, right? And there have been discussions among Zen teachers, how could this happen? And there was a discussion of Western Zen teachers after this book, Zen at War, came out. One Western Zen teacher said, there can be a level of awakening that may leave many, quote unquote, defilements and habit tendencies untransformed. There can be a level of awakening which leaves all sorts of stuff, including, you know, maybe social views, untransformed. That's interesting, isn't it? And we can see that, of course, we probably know better the numerous cases of Western teachers, primarily male, who have engaged in, to put it mildly, sexual misconduct, right? And some in the insight tradition, but more actually where teachers are more on their own, you know, in other, certainly in other Buddhist traditions. So I think how many of us are very aware of that, of some of these stories of Western teachers. Again, the question is, what do we make of this? You have a question of clarification?
Yes.
Yeah. I'll repeat it. If you could be brief, yeah.
Yes. How can someone be awakened and yet have hatred?
How can someone be awakened?
How do you hate the Jews and still follow yourself?
Or how can you be awake and have hatred? I think that's a question for his community, right? Right, so that's the point. He might have met some traditional models of awakening, but they didn't bring in that notion of that kind of hatred. So that might be a question we could come back to. We might, you know, what I'm going to basically say is that one way to talk about it is that we need further clarification of forms of greed, hatred, and delusion related to social conditioning. That's a way to actually not reject, as it were, greed, hatred, and delusion as the core issues or problems, but to say that we don't have maps that identify, that's more or less what I'm going to say, we don't have good maps that identify really in two main areas forms of conditioning, confusion, greed, hatred, and delusion. And those are in terms of psychological conditioning and in terms of social conditioning. And I'm going to say that we need to have maps of awakening which bring those in, and then practices which help us work through that conditioning. That's really all I'm going to say, you know, in essence, but I'll give some more detail. But that, and it probably, does that intuitively feel right? Yeah, I mean, it's so what I'm saying, I think, is intuitive, and yet are we doing it? Not that much, I would say. Right, so we have plenty of examples of manifestations of sexual abuse. We have manifestations that are sometimes not as blatant of conditioning around race, or, you know, or other dimensions of social conditioning, more like just not having it on the radar for teachers, you know. And so You know, many, many times I've heard many stories, particularly of practitioners of culture, of color, not feeling comfortable sometimes at retreats, or teachers saying things which are off in that way. Not as dramatic or blatant typically, but still there. And also in relation to sexual orientation. I've been present when these things have happened, you know, at retreats especially. So my response is to point to ways of bringing in our map of forms of greed, hatred, and delusion, bringing in dimensions of psychological conditioning and social conditioning. And then I can unpack that. You know, psychological conditioning would integrate a great deal of Western psychology. I've talked here at times about transforming the judgmental mind. And in that kind of work, I do integrate quite a lot of Western psychology. So there are ways of doing this, but basically much of this is at an early level, that integrating really deep work with psychological conditioning and social conditioning hasn't happened so much. It's, you know, with in terms of social conditioning just beginning to happen. For example, in terms of race, people like Ruth King and Rhonda McGee have just published books in the last few years, which give forms of practice. So I want to sort of finish by identifying 6 points that I think are crucial for this, what I'm calling a contemporary map of awakening. The first is, it's in part repeating what I said, we want to identify forms of greed, hatred, and delusion in detail related to psychological and social conditioning, you know, and bring that in. Again, this is just beginning to happen. Then secondly, we need forms of practice in which we integrate dimensions of Western psychology and identification of social conditioning with Buddhist practice. That takes time. In a way, that kind of integration is no different than what we find, or no different in broad scope with what we find in the movement of Buddhism, let's say, to China, where it takes something like 7 centuries. I think it'll be briefer here, 7 centuries to have a very deep integration of particularly the Chinese traditions of Taoism and Confucianism with the Buddhism of India, right? And that forms Zen and some other forms of Chinese Buddhism, which are uniquely Chinese, you know, and reflect really a deep integration of the holders of wisdom, ethics, meditation in China. It takes centuries, it takes time. So I think there's something comparable, and I think we find that in every culture. So it's not in essence different, you know, that, you know, Buddhism goes to other cultures and it becomes culturally appropriate, so to speak, one way to talk about it. So we need a whole new set of practices that would bring this out, that would be complementary to the practices we've received. That's the second point. Thirdly, we want to explore and clarify how much we bring in these contemporary practices and have them be parallel to the traditional model of awakening, and how much there's more of an integration. I would suspect that there'll be more and more of an integration. You know, even, for example, in my own practice, cultivating awakened awareness, I found myself needing to give a very contemporary reading, you know, and actually integrating grounding in the body and the heart with this vast awareness. I didn't receive those instructions from, for example, my Tibetan teachers or teachers in the Thai forest tradition. But I found when I was developing those practices myself, I had to make sure that I wasn't sort of developing something more mental. Because in the Western culture, we as practitioners often are not embodied, and we're often, not for everyone, but for many of us, we have a more mental notion of practice. We're not always connected with the heart. And so I found that necessary. That's an example. Fourthly, very crucial that the traditional model of awakening be central and be integrated. These are jewels that we've explored and that I've mentioned. Fifthly, the integration, I think, has occurred more so far in terms of integrating Western psychology, even though that has a long way to go, and less in terms of social conditioning and integrating that. That is just beginning. And, you know, it's, do we have practices to explore sexism and 5,000 years of patriarchy? You know, do we have practices that help us to look into that? I think I'd like to explore that maybe in a series of talks. I don't think we have that very well developed, even though scholars have pointed out the patriarchal dimensions of Buddhism, you know, for 30 years. And then lastly, I think that another dimension that will be contemporary is that awakening will occur in community more and more, as it does in the traditional context very much. But that, you know, we have to emphasize community coming from a hyper-individualistic culture. You know, we have to emphasize community. Some of you know that Thich Nhat Hanh once said that the next Buddha won't be an individual, but will be a community. You know that? He says, it's possible that the next Buddha will not take the form of an individual. The next Buddha may take the form of a community, practicing understanding and loving kindness, mindful living. This practice can be carried out as a group, as a city, as a nation. I think I'll just close with a vision, I think, of this practice from my friend and colleague, Larry Yang, who has a book called Awakening Together, which brings out that community aspect. I'll close with this. So this is a notion of, and he brings in the social dimension here. We endeavor to dissolve and transform all oppressions for the justice of all communities, for the freedom of all beings. I think he's meaning both inner freedom and outer freedom. We can only create justice through just means. That is also the truth, ancient and inexhaustible. This is the truth of awakening together. So let me stop here and invite just a moment of reflection. What resonated with you? Questions? Could be Linda's question we come back to. Just take a few moments. We have some time now for discussion, could be sharing something. If we're in the hall, we'll use the mic. If we're in on Zoom, we can, I think I can see everyone, although four people don't have their video on. But if you'd like to ask a question, and Bill, will you monitor the Zoom?
Yes, yes, I have a question from Nancy Langley.
Okay. Looks like Patty and Liz have questions.
Yes.
Yeah, the Zoom people are quicker with the questions.
They can go first. They can go first. I have a question from last week's homework, so.
That's fine.
Okay. This is a question from the heart. So, Donald, you ask us to take on some homework Sorry, I'm probably going to cry through this a little bit. And I decided to take on mindfulness. And, you know, this is what it's all about anyway. So, but I decided to really focus on it. And my husband died 6 months ago. And for the first time in my life, I've hit moments of despair. I have felt sad. I have felt, you know, all kinds of things, but I've never felt despair until lately, since he died. And I just wanted to know, I was trying to, when I was in the midst of that despair, the whole experience didn't last all that long, but I wasn't experiencing mindfulness at all during it. But anyway, I just would love to hear your comments. How do you practice? What do you do then?
What to do with despair?
Did
people in the hall hear the question? Okay, in the reflection. Yeah, I think there, Nancy, thank you for being willing to share that. There are a few responses or a few dimensions. I think it's not just one. And so when the despair surfaces and it's workable, you can bring mindfulness to the despair. When it's in the workable range. And just keep looking at it and watching it. It may be that there's a kind of grasping onto a storyline or a narrative. You want to look for that, especially with despair. Because I know for myself, in the grieving process, what I have found is that it's important to let everything come through, but then also to look for where there's something that where we latch on to a storyline or a narrative and get caught in it. And, you know, in the grieving process, that happens. And so when I give very, very brief grieving instructions, it's let the grieving process occur and see what gets in the way see where one gets stuck and see if you can look into that and let go. I don't know if the despair is around that, but it's very possible that there's a narrative that's forming that's kind of taking you over and you're not so aware of it. So you would want to work with that, you know, both with mindfulness. You can work in different ways. I work with grieving a lot with ritual as well, with different elements of ritual. And so be mindful of that despair. Know that it would be natural as occurring in the grief process. And, you know, like when I had an experience, I'll be brief here to get to the other questions, but I've talked some about, I had 1 month of meditation that started right after my mother unexpectedly died. So I got to watch grieving for a month, you know, with nothing else happening. And I could watch where things came that would get me a little bit stuck. So that just happens. And then hold it with kindness. So those would be the three things. Bring mindfulness when you can. If it's too much, then pull out of it and bring yourself back to balance. Hold it with compassion and loving kindness. And then look for whether there's a narrative that's kind of taking you over for a while, a storyline. And then see if you can identify that and work with it in some ways. That's a brief version.
Thank you.
I hope that's helpful.
It is helpful, Donald. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, so we have Patty and Liz.
Liz was the next one there.
Okay, great.
Liz?
Yes, thank you. Thanks, Donald. Can you guys hear me?
Yeah.
Okay, thank you. I love this talk. And I don't know why social awareness and psychological awareness can't be part of working on the absence of greed, hatred, and delusion.
Right.
Why couldn't that fit into that? Because in my mind, it does. Not being a sexual predator, caring about society and equality, why couldn't that fit in an absence of greed, hatred, and delusion? Secondly, I think I'm in the mindfulness meditation program with Jack Kornfield and Tara Brach. There's 2,500 of us all over the world. And part of our training is a session, our 6 sessions on racism, mm-hmm. and how to work with them in our, if when we're teaching, and how to work with those issues. I think the Vipassana community is working on this already. I'm concerned about secular Buddhism, which I think is raising its head. I'm concerned about mindfulness meditation, leaving out awakened awareness. I'm having a problem with teaching mindfulness. It's missing awakened awareness for me. But Larry Yang is a very strong...
Liz, just to jump in, just to make room for some other people.
Okay, sure.
For time, yeah.
I think it's happening in the Vipassana community. And it has to happen within each individual Buddhist community. Shambhala has a leader who is a sexual predator. We're doing it. I think we're doing it, Donald.
Let's see. So a few of the points. First of all, and this was really Linda's question as well, I think that greed, hatred, and delusion are broad enough concepts so that we could fit in issues of psychological conditioning and social conditioning, broadly speaking, into those categories. So I think those still can be useful. We can talk about, it's pretty easy to talk about racism, for example, in terms of greed, hatred, and delusion. But here we have to bring in a new map, also talk about greed, hatred, and delusion, which is certainly generally different from the way that we talk. Excuse me?
We lost you.
What's that?
We lost you for a minute, sound-wise.
Okay. I was able to hear myself.
Well, like, lucky you. We weren't as lucky as you were.
Yeah. Anyway, just to say that can fit into, I think we can fit in a sense of greed, hatred, and delusion and talk about psychological and social conditioning, but it needs to be broadened considerably. We need to talk about institutional dimensions of greed, hatred, and delusion. And then, yes, I think that some things are happening within the insight meditation world. They're starting, but they're fairly underdeveloped and undeveloped. And I don't know with detail all that you're exploring, but it's very helpful to look at, to look at racial conditioning. And I'd be interested to hear in detail what you're doing, but a lot of what I've seen is quite helpful. But if the integration with Buddhist practice is still fairly early, it takes time. I know from 30 years of socially engaged Buddhism, the integration takes time. So one can look at racism with very conventional Western social justice lenses, and that's important, but it doesn't reflect the full integration. That's what I'm pointing to.
Okay, I think it's definitely happening. I'm seeing it, and many of the teachers in the Vipassana community are also psychologists.
Liz, let me just make room for some other.
Okay, thank you. Thank you for bringing this up.
Okay, thanks. Patty, this may be the last one.
Hi, Donald. Thank you so much for this talk. I hope this is your next book, because this is a really interesting, the whole idea of a map is fabulous.
Yeah.
And I love the idea of creating a map with those perspectives. But my question is, can you please repeat, who is the author who is recommending the maps for Wake Up, Grow Up, Clean Up, and Show Up? Who was that?
This is Ken Wilber.
Ken Wilber. Thank you so much. I really
once did a book on him.
What was that?
I did a book on his work as well a while ago. Yeah.
You did? You wrote a book about him?
I co-edited a book and wrote about a quarter of it.
Which book is that?
It's called Ken Wilber in Dialogue.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Great. Thank you, Patty.